Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filmcast After Dark, the after show where we talk about a variety of random topics that did not make it into the show. I'm David Chen, and as usual, I'm joined by Devinder Hardor and Jeff Cannata, but today we have a very special treat for you. I'm going to list his credits in ascending order of importance and prestige.
Yeah.
He is the director of films like Prey, currently on Hulu, 10 Cloverfield Lane, the former co-host of the Totally Rad Show, and former guest on the Filmcast. Mm. Dan Trachtenberg.
I believe current guest on the Filmcast.
Dan Trachtenberg, welcome back to the Filmcast, man. How's it going today?
It's really great. I'm excited. I'm more excited to just be hanging with you guys than I am to be on the show. But I'm also... It's great.
Wow.
I'm glad that we're on the show, but like,
I mean, those are the best podcast interviews. You just want to hang out.
Yeah.
What a stirring indictment of the show. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Well, Dan, I have a bunch of questions, but this can be a hang. You know, we're just hanging, talking about the movie and other stuff like that.
We're not going to talk about the latest movie news, or
what do you want to talk about?
What we've been watching.
You are the latest movie news, Dan. You
That's
are the latest
true.
Movie
You
news.
Are what we've been watching.
Yes, according to statistics, you are number one on Hulu, the biggest movie or TV series premiere ever. Congratulations.
Wow. Thank you. I think that the more fun stat is that it's more watched than the Kardashians premiere.
Wow.
That's impressive.
Arguably a force more threatening to society than the Predator himself. you have taken down Dan Trachtenberg. Congratulations. So let's start by asking the question you've answered like 100 times, which is like, how did you happen to make the movie Prey? Like, how did the project come to you, or what was your sort of role behind bringing it to become a reality?
A few things sort of swirled around and then congealed into this. One was I was heavily inspired by Mad Max Fury Road, like so many, about making a movie that could be primarily told through action. But didn't want it to like just be a visceral experience. Was like, oh, but what if that could also be a deeply emotional one as well and thematic? So I thought about taking the engine from a sports movie, from an underdog story, and injecting that into a genre movie. And I think I've in general was just always really interested in period sci-fi, like the idea of there being visual effects in a historical setting. Was something that I'd been taken with and was trying to crack, and so in thinking about underdogs and wanting to do a man against the elements, but not just the elements, like what's the most formidable adversary, and so Predator kind of came to mind there, and then also thinking about who are protagonists that we never see, Native Americans and Comanche in particular are so often relegated to playing the sidekick or the villain and never the hero. So that all that came together to form this idea.
Gotcha. And was it always going to be a part of the Predator franchise, or was it kind of an independent action film that then became part of the Predator franchise?
It was always, the whole cool was like, oh my God, it's her up against the Predator, it's the Predator and Predator in this different setting. And, you know, even when the Fox Disney merger happened, that really buried this movie. And I think, by the way, I was thinking, Jeff, like when I told you guys, for the longest time, I never told you guys the movie that I was working on.
I know you kept saying it's really a Native American thing. This Native American thing.
Yeah. I kept pitching because that was the whole pitch in general. Was like, this is how I thought we were gonna. Hearing you guys review it, you know, it's like, highfalutin idea of mine to pull it off, but it wouldn't actually happen. But the secret sauce of it happening, why it worked with Split, and why we got away with what we got away with 10 Cloverfield Lane. Was that there already is a premise to sell,
mm-hmm.
So I thought that we could get away with it. And yes, so Jeff, to listeners, when I was hanging out with my friends, Jeff and the rest of the guys, we would play Dungeons & Dragons or board games together. I kept telling him about, I was making this movie set in the 1700s about a Comanche warrior proving herself, and was saving the predator part. I thought, wouldn't it be so awesome for you guys to be like, wait, what? You're like, man, what? Like,
It's just for your friends you kept it a secret.
Yeah, exactly.
You're really like trying to keep Jeff unsullied there. Like, this is the most like dangerous. You had a ticking time bomb, and Jeff is the worst person to drop it to. So amazing. Yeah.
Right. So, but then the Foxy's merger happened, and I so thought the movie wasn't going to happen that then I told you guys, I was like, now I don't feel like I'm jinxing it. Now I feel like if anything, I might be reverse jinxing it. Like maybe by me telling you,
yes. Classic reverse jinx.
Jeff's going to be talking it up so much around town that maybe he's going to cause the film to come into existence. Basically.
The reverse jinx is how most Hollywood projects get made. I don't know if you guys know that.
Right. But I was tempted at that moment. I think my reps even brought up like, well, you know, this is such a cool thing. Like maybe we should think about it not being a Predator movie. But the cool of it, it being a Predator brings so much more thematic weight to it that it would not have been as cool if it's just a creature in the woods. It makes it a better. Not only is the, you know, whatever we did story-wise about her make it a better Predator movie, but the Predator makes her story so much better. And it elevates, once again, the movie about these protagonists that we never see and a culture that we never see. It you know, putting it in a giant franchise movie sort of elevates that representation, recognition, all those things.
Yeah, so, it also allows you kind of... not to have movie stars because the movie star is the Predator.
Right.
Yeah.
That helps too. Yeah.
It's kind of like a form of franchise storytelling we don't see too much too, because like these days it feels really forced, like with Marvel and everything, whereas this is like you bring in what you know from Predator and people know a lot about Predator. So you can just like hit the ground running. And I definitely felt that in this movie. Yeah.
Although I'll tell you what's interesting. Jeff alluded to this in his review and your guys' review. It was much more that Devendra. And the drafts of it, certainly, and all the initial cuts. And what we learned in screening it for friends and family was like, oh, yeah. Like, and we're making this movie for non-Predator fans, too.
Right.
But even people who've seen Predator, like, the memory of it is sometimes different than the actuality of it. And we didn't always have trophy hunting in the movie. You know, we didn't see the Predator going after what he goes at, leveling up before he gets to her. We took all that stuff for granted. Like, oh yeah, people know what the Predator's motive is. We, you know, and so we actually did have to put that stuff in the movie so that it's all on the text. It's not just.
I will say my wife watched Prey, and it was her first Predator movie that she ever watched. And she did find it like comprehensible and like it all made sense.
Feel free to use that quote if you want for marketing. Comprehensible.
Comprehensible. Yeah. It was at the very least
understandable. To be comprehensible.
Hey, I have a question that I've never asked you, Dan. And was any part of this, I know you came to it eventually, but was part of the initial thinking about it motivated from Predator 2 and the gun at the end of that movie?
It was the thing that as the idea was forming, I was like, oh my God, right. It can, it can happen. And it's what drove the time period. It was like, I frankly was wanting to go back as far as possible. Because I really wanted to get away from 1800s, Western. That's where we always see.
Apocalypto versus Predator. Bound to happen.
But not apocalypto, but still, you know. But then the date on that gun was like, well, I have to do that. It has to be then. But the interesting thing is I thought everyone remembered that gun. I thought that was a very...
And I hadn't thought about that in like 25 years. So,
let's just clarify for people, like in case they don't know what we're talking about, that like at the end of Predator 2, they're picking up the dead Predator and a gun is handed over to Danny Glover's character that is from like the 1600s. And it becomes clear that predators have been 17. Hunting men for like many, many centuries. And that gun appears at the end of this movie, Prey, as well. So
well, appears throughout the whole film. But yes, the, yes, you're right. Gun 1715. I always assumed as soon as people saw people using guns that looked like that or hearing them say Raphael to him that it'd be like, oh, I see what the movie's doing. And thankfully, people don't remember Predator 2 as much. I mean, not thankfully, but...
the memory of those other Predator films is washed away.
It plays like a surprise.
It's a vaguer memory so that, that it can land powerfully at the end, but it also, you don't need to know that to for the ending to work, obviously. It's just a nice little nugget. But yeah, it did help confirm the cool of the movie, for sure.
Random note, I just finished reading Blood, Sweat, and Chrome recently, the Kyle Buchanan book about the making of Mad Max Fury Road. I don't know if you've read that book. Strongly recommend. I think you'd like. And it was interesting that at the end of the book, they talked about how, yes, Mad Max Fury Road didn't like make a ton of money, but in terms of cultural relevance... It's astonishing because it has inspired so many people to make films, to become filmmakers. So it's really cool. It's really cool when a movie has like cultural relevance, you know, and it inspires people like yourself. And now Prey will inspire a whole new generation of filmmakers as well. So
did it really not make money, Fury Road? I feel like it did.
It made a few $100 million, but it wasn't like, I mean, the movie took like decades to like plan and execute and, you know. So it wasn't like a bomb or anything like that, but it wasn't like, didn't make like $1 billion or anything. So,
When you're developing the script for this and you, I mean, you did develop the script, you like shepherded this from first thought to final execution, but when you're developing the script for this and you know, it's going to be mostly told through action as was your intention. Do you spell out all that stuff in the script? Are you like, as you're going, are you basically directing it in your head, storyboarding it in your head? You know, like, oh, I know how this action sequence is going to play, or is it, is, does that come later when you're actually in pre-production?
It's a little bit of both. There's stuff that the writer Patrick, wrote that like mud pit sequence was always there. It was like we really wanted there to be a man against the elements before we're even dealing with Predator, and like we wanted to make sure she's and have that like adventure movie vocabulary, you know, like having a quote-unquote quicksand scene. That's why she slides so much in the movie, because all those movies we grew up in, Willow, they're always sliding, and you know, all these movies, they're slide. Predator, actually, there's this, he's
good sliding action.
So when the movie to have that visual language in it, but
hard to do in the forest, by the way.
We made it work. Secret is you put down mats that are very slippery, and then you cover those up, or you digitally erase them.
I thought you were about to say, Dan, that the whole mud pit sequence, like you just found a mud pit as you were shooting. Like, this is crucial. This could be crucial to our entire movie.
No, so that's something that was there from the beginning and is great, crafty suspense sequence. There's many others that like Burnt Glade sequence was absolutely written, but. I think Cut Clamp was an early idea, but so many things evolved.
Sorry, can you just explain what these are for people who don't?
Burnt Glade sequence is, sorry, thank you, Dave. The Burnt Glade sequence is the sequence in a burnt out glade covered in smoke and ash when the Predator and the Fur Trappers and Nadu and Tabi, when they all clash and they're used as bait and... it's when the Predator really unleashes using all of his gadgets. But the netball, like so many things came from working with ADI, the people that built the weapons and the suits, and seeing things that they had tried to do in previous movies that didn't happen, or just riffing off of fun, the previous team, like riffing off of fun ideas. And then there's sequences like the tall grass sequence was... Before we got greenlit, they wanted me to do a previs to help sell the movie to higher ups. And so we did the scene where he takes down all the Comanche warriors, with lots of things that were either in the script or new ideas that come from, oh, what if we did that? Oh, this cool thing or that cool thing. And then the tall grass sequence was just me thinking, oh, you know what's not in the movie and what I want to make sure that we're selling, because if I'm just going to show them a fun action scene, they're not going to see all the pretty stuff before we even go on the journey. So I was like, well, maybe I can do pretty with action. So the tall grass sequence was like, oh, well, have it all sunset and did it, you know. And that came from just that idea of trying to sell the movie. None of that was scripted. The script then had to write to the scene that we just entirely, you know, figured out visually. And there's a number of those. There's a number of, like, Tabe's fight with the Predator was all choreography first and then written second.
I like how, first of all, you're one of the smartest people about film that I know, Dan, and you're like, I wanted to combine pretty with action. sometimes you just need the raw language sometimes. You mentioned some of the stuff that made it into the film was stuff that didn't make it into other films. So, like, are you able to provide an example of, like, something that was supposed to be in another?
I don't know if I can remember. It's more of, like, yeah, I don't know if I will remember. The netball wasn't. The cut clamp wasn't.
So netball is the thing where he throws the net on the guy and then it, like kind of...
It's hard to see it in the way it's shot, but yeah. I actually have it right over there. But it's, you know what? Hold on. I'll show you.
Oh, wow. If you're listening to this, Dan Trachtenberg is leaving his chair and getting up to get a prop from the movie, I think.
Yeah. Be careful with that.
Yeah, you kept that around just in case your daughter is and it needs to be disciplined, right?
Yeah. That's, yeah.
Oh, no.
Oh, rad.
Wow. Oh, that's so cool. Wow. You should, if you're listening to this, you should totally be watching the YouTube version at youtube.com/.
Seeing the prop
light. Yeah. It's that's amazing.
I'm helping out here. It's a ball. Netball or END, explosive net device. So he throws the ball then unfurls into the net, wraps around the object, and then gets sucked back into ball again.
Amazing.
Going through whatever it needs to go through.
Incredible.
So that maybe the
was that something that they wanted to use in another film?
I don't think so. I don't think this came from. I feel bad. I really honestly don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was more like design choices and mm-hmm. maybe what his loincloth or the backpack. And mm-hmm. I mean, those things are in the other movies. But yes. And the crossbow was just meant to. I sort of wanted everything he used to be an advanced version of what adversaries were using against him. So when people mm-hmm. are fighting with their lances, he's using his combi stick. When they're shooting bows and arrows, he's got his crossbow, mainly for those fights, for the Comanche warrior fight and the fur trapper.
Behind the original Predator too, right? Like, I think that's a really interesting balance. You could tell he's an older Predator from a different time. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then there was a net established in Predator 2, I should say as well, but the net just like goes on top of the guy. That's where, you know what, that's what it was. The very first, in one of the first drafts with Patrick, there was a net wrapped around a guy, and then he had to like get something. The Predator was coming, and he was like reaching for his gun, so he like chose to like put his arm through, like slice his own, you know, whatever to reach it was like that sort of a suspensey sequence, and then all that evolved into netball and then eventually the shield. And the shield, as I've mentioned this before, but you know, as you guys know, but that's really just from watching God of War. as is the tomahawk, you know.
Yeah, like, yeah. It's interesting you mentioned that the Predator is using more advanced weaponry in all cases, because it kind of brings me to a question that I'm very curious about what your opinion on, which is the Predator an asshole in your opinion?
Is he like, is he a punk ass, as we laid out in our review?
Is he an asshole in his homeworld? Do you know, what is your opinion of the Predator in his homeworld?
Well, as you astutely pointed out, it's It's not unlike what we do, and but I will say, it's not unlike what all living creatures. Everyone's using their advantage to survive and to win. So a wolf is not going to not use its teeth because the bunny rabbit doesn't have teeth.
Sure.
You know, like,
but the predator's not doing this to survive. He's doing this for fun.
Yeah, he's doing it for fun.
Is. What does it tell the bunny rabbit to get a rabbit's foot? You know,
the predator does have some honor, and is only fighting what he thinks is the alpha, and is a worthy adversary, what he deems as a threat, what's a worthy trophy.
To be fair, he's doing a lot of experimentation on the way to that.
Yes, yes.
Look at this little snake. The snake seems dangerous. I'm gonna get this guy. Yeah.
Well, the snake attacked him.
Yeah.
These are things that attacked. So.
Imagine being a predator and going to a world and finding snake is the worst thing on the entire world.
Just like, I spent all this money
on my hunting trip.
And
I just found
all this gear. Yeah.
I found a snake. Snake is the worst thing.
On the Care Bear planet? Sucks. God.
By the way, I mean, I imagine hunters go out trying to, or fishermen go out hoping to catch the big guy, and sometimes they only end up with the. They're like, I guess this is all the sea has brought me today.
Like a minnows,
minnows. So wait, what was you were saying? Is
the predator an asshole?
No, is he an asshole? So yeah, no, I do. The whole challenge of the design of the predator was, how can he feel prior to what we've seen before, but without making it like. Oh, we just made it easier for Nadu to win, for our hero to win. Like, still, we have to embrace the like, but he's so far advanced that it feel impossible. And the real guide was Rogue One. Was like, and this is more from aesthetic than from concepts of things.
Mm-hmm.
But as we've all complained about the Star Wars prequels having that issue of like, oh, this is before, but yet it all feels newer, and you know. And I wanted the movie to feel modern in some ways, be cool, nice, pretty, aesthetically pretty and enjoyable to watch, but also the things need to feel old. So I think Rogue One does a really good job of embracing the 77 Star Wars aesthetic, but rendered with modern sensibilities. So that's all of these things, a cloak that does not work very well, that's fritzing all the time, and cross bolt. You know, shooting bolts as opposed to a plasma caster, you know, still feels like impossible and very advanced compared to sticks and stones, but yet, you know, older than what we've seen in the Predator franchise before.
Very cool. I read an interview with you that Jermaine Lussier conducted. Terrible box office prognosticator, I want to point out, by the way.
That's coming to a head soon, isn't it?
Don't remind us.
Indeed.
There's a storm on the horizon.
Not good.
Well,
the three faces you see in front of you, not positioned well for that.
The questions, one of the questions was like, when we were going to first find out that it was like the Predator that was... the Predator was in the movie, and I think you originally had wanted it to be like that bear sequence. Is that correct? Am I
yeah,
recalling
well,
this correctly?
No, it was the what I wanted was there to be a I never thought it would really get all the way with the movie.
Yeah,
but what I wanted was the trailers to be because initially I was hoping that the movie could be underway before Shane's movie came out, before the last Predator movie came out. So that there'd be, you could see a trailer for this movie that's just the first part with this girl going out to prove herself and then sees a fire in the sky. And you'd be like, oh, what the fuck is that crazy movie? You know? And you already feel like, oh, sci-fi, but with that, and that, you know, that, but that's all you get. And there'd be no title. And then when the 2018 Predator movie came out, attached to that would be the full trailer for this movie where it reveals, and then of course using the bear sequence, so in the blood you reveal the shape and you go, oh my god, that movie we've already been interested in, like that yeah. was a Predator movie. You know?
I do miss the days of mystery trailers. So like, I think the first Cloverfield did that, right? Yeah. Very, very sure. memorably.
Have you heard of that movie, Dan?
Mm-hmm. yeah. It's a line. I mean, there's literal video of me, Jeff and Alex on the Jelly Rad Show where I think Alex too, but I was convinced that he was saying there was a Voltron movie.
Right. Right,
they were
right,
saying yeah. it's a lion.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah. So
yes. So originally
it shows yeah. how long you were working on this. Cause you're like, oh, maybe the second trailer will come out in 2018.
Yeah. Yes.
You know?
So the idea is that like, you might've heard about this Prey movie a long time ago. And then when you go see the Predator movie in theaters, you see a trailer for Prey and you're like, holy crap, they did another Predator movie like on top of this one. You know, and that would have been like an amazing.
So awesome. What a thing. Yeah. I mean, I don't even like trailers, but that would have been an incredible cultural reveal, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Totally.
I would have made you watch that.
Yeah. I gotta say one of the things, I don't want to skip ahead. I know we're kind of starting at the beginning of this journey, but one of the things that I think is so cool about what is happening now with the reception of the movie is how, at least in my circle of Twitter followers and websites that I visit and stuff, it really feels like Prey has kind of single-handedly brought Predator back to the zeitgeist in a way that none of the other, like the Shane's movie didn't, you know, say what you will about it. I think there's some fun stuff in that movie, but like, I think it's amazing that Prey has revitalized this franchise. Do you feel that as well?
I mean, yeah, for sure. It's so funny because I, Predator has come back in my life for fast 5 years.
Yeah.
So like I'm so steeped in looking at that creature and the lore and and the other movies and all those things and reminding myself what I liked about the other movies and what I could be different or whatever. But I definitely see the reaction and love the way it makes people remember their fondness for the original movies and seeing people who've never seen it and just fully embrace this movie. And I mean, the thing that I really love is just that there's two things that are amazing. One is, seeing people have an emotional reaction to a Predator movie, like it getting the thing that I'm always after is like, can a movie, you know, medicine and ice cream, you know, like can it be good, and also taste good, and just work on that visceral level, and like there was a screening, we did several screenings in Oklahoma. We did one we were just working on the movie just for help in the making of it. But also, now that it's done, it's screened in like four screens at the same time. At the end of the movie, there's the dedication card to the Comanche Nation and Juanita, who was someone who worked on the movie. And you could hear the Lulus coming from other theaters, like through the theater wall, like it's just like you know, it's amazing that this could function, that this Predator, just go see action, like can actually be an elevated, well, hopefully it's an elevated movie, but also like an elevated experience, you know, culturally.
Because these things matter. Like, I think it's easy to forget this too for people. Like, as a kid, looking at things, I had Temple of Doom, not so great at times, and I had Hook, which I really latched onto. And I think a lot of kids, especially a lot of like Indian kids and South Asian kids, like Southeast Asian kids, really hooked onto Rufio because he was the most badass kid in the world. So to have a character like we do here in Prey, and having honestly the entire cast. I think it's just great work here. People are really going to look up to this movie. Yeah.
One of the saddest things is Amber Midthunder, plays Nadu. Her dad loved these like Looney Tunes. I don't know if it's actual Looney Tunes, but there's these, I think it may be in the Looney Tunes family, the Hanna-Barbera. I don't know what it is, but there's these really horribly racist cartoons with rotten portrayals of Native Americans. And he loved them because it was him. You know,
that's all he had.
Oh, I'm in a cartoon, yeah. You know, growing up as a kid, saying her dad's experience.
I tried rewatching the original, the Disney Peter Pan, and that movie is not in the children's account for Disney because of horrible native representation. Also, there's a very big warning.
There's
up
a disclaimer in front of it
now,
there's
right? There's a disclaimer. So I just fast forward that stuff when my daughter is watching because she's into Peter Pan now, but she doesn't need to see that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, the thing about, like, for I really reflected on when I grew up, the things that I loved were Kevin Arnold on The Wonder Years and Ralph Macchio and The Karate Kid. I loved movies about scrawny kids that were teased because I was a, you know, that then, and the reason why it's not just, it very much is, seeing someone that looks like oh, I exist in the world, because movies, media is the mirror that we like. You look in a mirror before you go outside. You go, what do I look like? You know, and movies are like the cultural mirror of like how do I exist in the. And as a kid, it's like I needed to see a movie where someone who was like not the good looking, not the jock, not the alpha, you know, like oh, they can get a girl. They can, I was like, oh, okay, it can happen for me. And you take mental notes of like, oh, do I approach a girl? What do I, you know, like to someone that looks like you, it's possible. You know, this is a very like surfacey, you know, I could move through the world and not feel venom from people or Texas, you know. But that stuff really does. We look to things, stories are what we look to help us. So it's just, I think, duly important that there are now characters that are positive, that that look like people that grew up without seeing that ever, that go, oh, that might feel like, oh, am I a sidekick in light? You know, am I like, I'm not really the person that's the focus of things, that I'm not as important as other people are. Dave, you speak to this, you know, we've spoken to this a bunch with Asian American representation and like, Crazy Rich Asians, all that, you know, but also everyone too, can identify with her, with what she's going through, which is also the, like, I think of, like, I you know, it, when you become a friend with someone, you know, like people are becoming friends with her now, you know? So like now we have, they have a friend.
They have a parasocial relationship with
yes,
her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good yes. Way. Yeah, right, yeah. Right, right.
On that note, I mean, that's one of the big challenges of doing representation, so we are told, right? Is that, oh, people, there's been no woman superhero that's made a bunch of money. There's no Asian American superhero that's made a bunch of money in the past. So therefore we shouldn't make more of them. We shouldn't make any of that thing because it's not going to make money. Right. I have to imagine that the casting for this movie and obviously the concept for the movie was a challenge to get made. And I'm curious, like, A, was it in fact a challenge to get made with this cast, with this lead? And B, if so, how did you kind of overcome some of those challenges?
Well, I should say there was no challenge from the premise. There was no challenge from the idea that this movie would be entirely focused on this culture and these would be the protagonists, and that, you know, like there was never a pushback from that. Yes, production wise there's challenge, casting wise it's a limited pool of people, you're seeing less performers, so that has its own set of challenges, and we ended up casting people with limited experience, so that has inherent challenges, but it also there's upsides to that. I mean, there's, you know, there's upsides not only in the end result of it, if it's good, and then these people, you know, have now have opportunity they didn't have before, but also as a director working with that, there's benefits to working with veterans, people who really know, and, you know, yeah. There's also benefits.
And then sometimes you work with like a diva, like a Jeff Cannata, let's say, you
right,
know?
Right. And it's just, and it's awful. And
it's just like, yeah. Unthinkably
bad. For the whole show.
There's also something to working with people who are fit. We get to have our mm-hmm. This is only my second time making a movie. You made a few things, but like
you get to introduce them to the world.
Get to introduce it, and we're figuring it out together, and are very open Very open to and eager to do a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And like, so Dakota, who's the namely, you know, has never been anything ever, not a commercial, not a nothing.
Which is incredible to think about, right?
Like, watching him, I felt like seeing Sung Kang for the first time in both Better Luck Tomorrow and Tokyo Drift. Like, this guy, so much charisma. Yeah. I want to see him in everything. So I hope he gets
such
a lot.
Good, by the way, like a good human, just a good, but what a, you know, wonderfully raised person. And also did all of that. So he was like down to do all of it, and he is rolling around. There's he jumped off that horse. I mean, he just did everything, so, and he rode on the horse. I mean, it's like it's unreal what he did. On top of being incredibly charming and winning, and captured, what could have been a little eye rolly and representing gender roles, and
yeah, it's like the patriarchy. He's sort of
he found a way to be at times adversarial to his sister and represent a very natural sibling relationship, but also being really warm. So there were so many scenes that we were like, we struggled in writing. We're like, oh, that's gonna be too harsh for him to say to her. That's gonna cut too deep. We won't like Tabe. And when Dakota does it, it's like, oh, let's make it, he can say way worse. We can just make it, you know, because he just can't, we can't not like that guy, you know?
That's great. Is it true that he previously worked at a TJ Maxx?
Yeah. Yeah. He worked at TJ Maxx up until because, like coming to Calgary to shoot the movie. Why? What is the,
we might get a Filmcast exclusive here, but you know that Dan Trachtenberg once directed a commercial for TJ Maxx.
No, what? No.
Wasn't TJ Maxx?
No, you misremember.
Was it Marshall's?
Wow. It was AJ Wright.
AJ Wright, which is TJ Maxx.
I think it's owned by TJ Maxx.
In part of the country, it's AJ. It's TJ Maxx, and it's AJ Wright. Wow. It's the same thing.
But it was AJ Wright.
Anyway,
so your careers have basically mirrored each other. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I don't know if I will further do a Filmcast exclusive because
well, the first one went so well.
Yeah, yeah. Let's keep going.
Would you, hey, David Devendra, would you like to guess who the star of that AJ Wright commercial was?
Is it someone who's on the podcast?
That's right.
Devendra?
It was me, guys.
Dan has actually directed me. That's right.
Wow. So funny. Just to digress and tell a little bit of that story. Have you guys heard this before, Jeff and Devendra?
I've never told anybody about it. I don't mean to make this about me. I just thought it was funny. No, when I heard TJ Maxx, I was like, that's a weird connection. Anyway.
Yeah. I was directing this commercial, and Jeff was just in the casting for it, not related to me in any way. And I was like, I can't like just say Jeff. Even though I probably could have now in retrospect. By the time I was like, I'm a director. I can't, you know.
I like the look of this one. Yeah.
And they chose the client chose Jeff to be in the commercial above anyone else. Like, and I remember talking to Jeff. I was like, okay, I haven't told them yet. You know, I was like, I guess we just. And now it feels weird. I don't know when I should say it. So.
Everybody knows everybody in Hollywood, right? So sure, yeah.
Yeah, but no, that's why I just didn't tell them that I knew Jeff. And then we were shooting the commercial, and then we broke for lunch, and then Jeff and I sit together at lunch, and we're like palling around, and I realized this looks so weird to the other people at the table who were like the director and the star, like are like. Just like really canoodling, elbowing each other, like it was like such an uncomfortable memory in retrospect to think back on it.
I was talking to the director in a way that you really shouldn't talk to someone who you're
giving
working
him noogies,
for,
yeah. Like yeah. Just yeah. doing all this stuff, yeah.
giving noogies. Oh my god!
So. Yeah. Speaking of, so, and how was the commercial, Dan? Are you, is it, was it a good ad for
by the way, not very good.
You never show it to anyone.
Somebody find this commercial. I'm sure it's on YouTube.
Oh, it's on the internet.
It was like a, it was weird. It was like
it's just all dancing. It's all dancing. But yeah, Dan would like that commercial buried. And for me, it's like the high point of my career.
It's the job of our listeners to unearth it.
Yeah, unearth it. And undoubtedly, this will be very damaging to Dan's career. So, but speaking of casting, let's just talk a little bit about Amber Midthunder. I mean, obviously she's amazing in the movie. She anchors the whole movie. At the same time, she hadn't been, I don't think she's had a role that has demanded
this
much.
She's been working a lot. Like, I was looking for her IMDb. She was in Legion, like in a pretty major role. Yeah. Like, she's been working since 2001. So,
but this is a thing where she has to like anchor the whole movie in a very action heavy way. And I am curious, like, what was the process of casting? Like, when did you feel like you knew you had the right person for this movie?
Frankly, I knew it the second that I met. We did an initial audition over Zoom or FaceTime before pre-pandemic. So Zoom didn't exist before the pandemic. It was just Skype. So we Skyped.
Skype really blew the lead, don't you think? Anyway, go ahead.
I mean, that's the whole story. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Zencaster's really, where was this the whole time? She was just terrific. And I knew, you know, her mom is a casting actor, but her mom also does stunts.
Mm-hmm.
Her dad's an actor and very physical. And I had this good feeling like, oh man, it must be a part of the equation for her. And then we did chemistry tests. So a little bit more of an extensive audition. And she auditioned the scene between her and her mother three different ways. She did it once in English, once in Comanche, and then also non-verbally, which is a thing that I did. I've done before. I never did an audition that way, but I'd done it for scenes in things I've worked on. And so it's doing a dialogue scene, but without the ability to use words, you know, just having to convey everything. It was beautiful. She was so, it was incredible. And that's such a big part of this movie is telling story non-verbally. And then there was a physical component. There was a stunt coordinator there, and we developed this little obstacle course to see how they moved. Cause I just, as you guys know, growing up on the same kind of action movies that I grew up on, the way people move is so much of the fun of an action movie. So, wanted to see, you know, wanted to analyze that. And it wasn't just about the physical movements for her. Like, she was continuing to tell story in all the running and crawling and jumping and all those things, you know. So, so that sort of just confirmed what I had felt initially. And yeah, as you guys pointed out, she's great. We really,
I mean, she comes from good action blood too, right? Like, her dad was the model for Nightwolf in Mortal Kombat. Mm-hmm. Like, he's a working actor. He's all over the place too. So yeah. Her determination and fierceness reminded me of like Lady Snowblood, you know, going back, or even the Bride from Kill Bill. Like, there's a lot she can tackle all at once. Yeah.
We referenced, a lot of Jackie Chan. She was like, I definitely felt very uncomfortable every time I brought it up, because she's like, why are we talking about Jackie? I kept making her watch things, because it was all about the thing I kept on showing her. This is just the audience for this anecdote. But I remember in Armor of God, there's just a tiny bit where he's chewing on gum. And or he like throws the gum against.
Yes. It bounces back
and it bounces back into his mouth. And it's like, oh yeah, this guy's like cool. And he's capable of things. Like, it was such a challenge with her to find a way in which you believe that she's not a zero. She's not the nerd who becomes the hero. She's not.
Right.
She's starting at a place where there is physical competence. But she is not all the way there. She's got to earn her stripes. She's got to go through some shit. For me, it was like, how can there be just something in her physicality that feels like she does feel there is a capability, but that isn't like, I'm the most badass that ever badass, you know? So it's in the little touches of like the tomahawk. She like flips the tomahawk up and cut. That was kind of the main Jackie Chan influence, is like, that and her sliding down the mountain and kicking off, and like, so even the little moments, there's just a little bit of swashbuckle to it that you just believe her physical center. So
yeah, that's
that was the whole point of me making her watch a million Jackie Chan movies, was just for like those two things. But
I love that mental image, by the way, of Dan Trachtenberg showing Amber Mid-Thunder Jackie Chan movies and her being like, what are you?
Stop calling me Jackie. I can't be Jackie Chan, okay?
the other thing was, well, I'm also throwing on the gauntlet. I'm like, hey, I want you to do this stuff. I want to see your face while you're doing it. But the other thing of finding the way that she fights, as you guys know, like, I was very excited, or as you can imagine, I was very excited to like finally make like an action, a hand-to-hand action scene in the movie. It cannot be martial artsy in any way.
Mm-hmm.
But yet I wanted there to be cool, clever choreography, you know? So that was really hard too, to like find the way she can fight and devise all that stuff. Could scratch that itch without it being just like, and now there's martial arts in a movie, and it's not Shanghai Noon or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah. I love what you said about the, about her, not being all the way there yet at the beginning of the movie, because I think that's what's so wonderful about her relationship with her brother is like, there is this layer with her peers of sexism, right? But her brother's also right. Like, He's right. He's like, you shouldn't come out. You shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't try to do that all by yourself. You did fall. I did have to carry you back. Like, he's right. And I love that dichotomy of like, yes, she's fighting against unfair characterization of her, but also she's not there yet. You know, mm-hmm. I thought that was a wonderful line to thread.
It's also interesting you bring that up because, There's actually very little sexism in the text of the movie, and there's really only one line. That's when Wasabe's name of the character is Stormy, the asshole says like, yeah. We don't need a cook, right? That's the only line that like everything else. What everyone's commenting on is her ability. It's not her gender that's preventing her. What the mom says about her is based on her ability. What we've seen from her up until, you know, when those people make those comments are all her failing. Even though we were like, oh, she almost got, she could probably do it. But she hasn't. She didn't get the deer in the beginning. She didn't get the hawk. She doesn't get the cat. She doesn't do all, you know, and it's all based on ability. The gender divide is there. It's mostly implied through visuals and just sort of what people bring to the movie. And certainly there's an accuracy to it, which is another reason why it's Comanche specific, which is because it was not those gender roles were not the case for many Native American or First Nations tribes. But we're for Comanche. But that's not the most interesting part of it, you know, and that's not what the movie wants to spend its time on. And the movie got better. It was more about that in the script and initial versions of the movie. And we realized that is absorbed in a nanosecond. We do not need any more characters saying that again and again and again. And even now, I'll see some negative reviews of the movie that bring up other movies, and it's like, wow, it's one, it's actually just a line, you know, maybe two. It's the, you know, the other guy's addictor too on the line tree.
You're saying you'll see reviews saying that it's heavy-handed what the movie's trying to say about
right,
sexism.
Right. Mainly about sexism or gender, you know, and it's not really in the text.
Mm-hmm. Compared to a movie like Captain Marvel or something, where I think it's very explicit at every point and she fights to just a girl, you know, like,
yeah,
it's much more subtle here. I really appreciate that. I'm wondering, Dan, like talking about like what this movie is covering too. Like there has been a lot of hateful response to this movie too, from certain elements of the Predator fan community. And I feel like we see that with every property these days. Is that something you guys were prepared for? And just how are you dealing with it now? Like, are you guys, you know, helping to make sure like Amber's not being, you know, inundated by these people too?
I don't think she is. It's not, there was more before the movie came out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or frankly, there was more before a trailer had even come out. It was just, you know,
just the idea. Just the idea.
It was just the idea. Yeah. But also, it you know, I feel like there's just every opinion is going to be had about everything till the rest of time. Everyone will have any opinion that can be had. Someone's going to have it. So people feel a certain way. Okay, let them feel it. It's so outnumbered by the positive reaction, you know. And I thought there'd be way more of that based on those initial feelings. I know they exist, but it's barely permeated. Mm-hmm. And I think Amber's really enjoying people that are picking up what you put down, you know.
That's great. There seem to be a lot of comments from people who completely miss what happened in the first Predator movie. Like completely
that was the
miss
weirdest
the point.
Thing. Yeah. That was the strangest reaction. Is those if Arnold, you know, can't do it with all of his, like, that's the point of that movie.
That's the point of the movie.
That's the point.
So,
of the,
so let's like, let me just articulate what you're describing, mm-hmm. right? Like there's some toxic males online that basically think, oh, if Arnold and his crew of like extremely heavyweights with all this weaponry couldn't take down the Predator, but this girl could and Prey, that makes no sense. Like that's the complaint, right? But as you point out, Dan, that was the whole point of the first movie is like they couldn't face him when they were trying to use brute force, right?
The guns did nothing.
Exactly. Switch off the targeting computer, Luke.
Right.
Right. But also, it's also like I hesitate to correct those people because that is what makes this movie better is feeling like it's impossible for that's kind of what I want. It's like you want people to not remember it perfectly because really what Arnold ends is where Amber begins. You know what I mean? Like, and I don't want that kind of ruins the movie if you do remember it perfectly. And it is more exhilarating to feel like how is she so many people remember it that way and not horrible people like open-minded people but still were like wait but Arnold couldn't so how and then when they watch the film it's like such a rewarding reaction to see step by step. This is a thing that Jeff I know you love too that I love and probably got some appreciated from the way you've articulated about Breaking Bad, right? About seeing people go through processes or you always say competence porn, you know.
Yeah.
But like I like you witness her do it, you witness each that's so fun to see. It's not there's never this like oh then suddenly she has this special skill that we no you have to see her fail what's that fortress is back, what's that fortress is back to earn it. And frankly what I really didn't want to do was what the original movie did when the Predator disarms itself. Mm-hmm. To make it because it does have a code because it's not a punk ass bitch in that movie, right? It has a code, and
you're
it,
walking
and,
around it, fully invisible.
I know.
Yeah.
But once again, we
yeah we wear camo in the woods.
We wear camo in the woods, and when we're fighting our fight, we use all of our advantages against whatever we need to survive against. But yeah. So I really wanted Nadu to have to disarm it get rid of its advantages.
You're referring to the fact that in the first Predator movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger the Predator kind of turns off its invisibility at the end and fights it kind of one-on-one basically
and takes off its helmet.
Yes.
Yeah.
And loses its advantage in heat vision, you know, all those things. It says I'm gonna now get into a fist fight with you, which is the only thing that gives him a fighting chance. And Nadu in this movie has to create level the odds herself, has to give herself her own fighting chance.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I talked about in our review that I absolutely love is exactly what you're talking about, which I think this movie does so well, specifically with the you know the quicksand pit moment where she's throwing the thing, and we get so many of those Oh, okay, well now this is the one that's going to work. No, it still doesn't work. Oh, okay, she got it. Oh, the branch breaks. I just love the progression of that. And it is exactly what you're talking about.
Speaking of the reaction to the movie, I mean, I think what's so cool about witnessing the reception to the movie, Dan Trachtenberg, is obviously we've known each other for a really long time. And like, I know that you grew up as a fan of franchises like the Predator franchise. Now you have basically become part of the franchise. Like you grew up like admiring it, loving it, and now you have like created an entry into it that is widely admired. I'm curious, you know, I've seen like Jesse Ventura tweet at you and like other people tweet at you. And I guess I'm curious, like, are there any reactions that really mean a lot to you, or that were like extremely powerful to you as somebody who grew up loving these movies?
Yeah, from the Predator side of things. I mean, you just saying that just now is cool.
Yes, and of course, David Chen saying it. Yes, well, I agree. No, it's a big deal.
But also just reminding, like, yeah, I made a Predator. That's, it would just happen while we, you know, you get so consumed by work on set. Someone, yeah, you know, my script supervisor or second AD is over, like, we're making a Predator movie. Like, because also, because there's a lot of this movie that is not, you know, in the production of it, there's lots of days where there's no Predator to be seen, you know, yeah, and then the Predator's on set, but it was also like, you know, it's, the suit doesn't work and we gotta, you know, like, it's hard, you know. Yeah. And then, but then sometimes it does sink in, you're like, wait, this is Predator, this is like, this isn't, and it's not like a fan film, it's not like, you know, it's like, no, this is now inside, this is now,
yes, you're part of the can, you are part of the canon now.
It is so weird, it's so weird, it it's weird. I don't even, like, I know what you say, because I know what I would be saying that to something else, you know, but I know that I'm not absorbing it,
mm-hmm,
the way that I'd want that person to, you know, like, I know what you mean, but
you're not having the reaction that you,
because I'm inside
you would want if you were me talking
yeah,
to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just inside it. It just was the thing that I was working on, you know what I mean, like, it was hard to make, and now like, you have an intimate knowledge of the Predator, like, I see the suit, you know, I don't, you know, like, I, you know,
you've ruined Predator for yourself forever, basically.
Yeah,
maybe movie.
I don't know. Yeah.
I remember the day you were texting me and others about seeing the costume test the first time, and I remember you reacting to that like someone walked into a room dressed like Predator for you to approve. You know, like,
yeah, that was crazy. That, and I will say, opposite of what I'm saying now, it was a little scary in the way that you do when you go to like Universal Horror Nights or like a, and when people come at you, like, you, there's a primal, like, I'm a little scared. And it's so big. Mm-hmm. It was dark in the woods. It was getting dark out, and it was like, oh shit, it's scary. It so there was, and maybe it was a little bit of a primal, like, it brought out that feeling that I had.
He's got a skull on his head, you know. It's a,
yeah,
it's freaky. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, that was cool. Yeah, no, it's cool.
Yeah,
it's
but
cool, Dave. I don't
any
know.
Other
cool.
kind of reactions to the movie that like you were surprised by, or that really delighted you?
I mean, it's seeing. I mean, certainly, I cannot even really put into words the Native American and First Nations response. Those things, this guy does these YouTube videos, Native Media Theory, that even just when the trailer came out, his analysis, he's you would love him, David. He constructs his videos, I think, very well. And the way that he read the movie was just so awesome. And even the final reaction. I mean, I'm enjoying, I watched the reaction videos. Those are, they're so great. They're so great. What a rare gift we have. It's only, you know, we only get it today that the filmmaker did not have 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
For better
get,
or worse.
You get
yeah.
a critic's
yeah.
reaction. For better or worse. But for better or worse, right? But you know, so often you get reactions that are the lump sum feeling after I've seen the movie that sometimes go into bits of detail. But to be able to watch specific moments and see how those things land for people, and, you know, you're hoping that you've done the math right, you've done your craft right, and like, this should affect a person this way. And then all of it is, I was just talking to another filmmaker, and the thing we were saying is like, I think the overwhelming feeling I have with there being a positive reaction to the movie is relief that I'm not crazy, you know? Because yeah. like, It, the whole time, this is a bolder idea for a movie, to what to do with the franchise, and it's like, and the crew is trusting. And the whole time, you're like, not. Sometimes people sort of half get what you're after, mm-hmm. and you know, okay, as long as they half get it and they half get it, I know when we put it together, it's gonna. Mm-hmm. Then they'll see. You have all. There's so many of those. They'll see. They'll see, you know, hopefully, oh my God, fuck, what if they don't see them?
I'll show you all.
They'll hate me. So you want to make them proud. They put a lot of hard work into it. The production crew, the prep crew, they put a lot of hard work. You want to make sure they're proud of it. same thing with the poster, of course, they're there as it's coming together and seeing it. But then even we're done, like, oh, people, Jeff saw, or he was, oh, it's cool. Like, okay. So someone liked it, but I don't know, you know, so then it gets bounced around. It's just like,
I agree.
Okay.
I don't trust Jeff's opinions either.
but thank God we're not crazy. Yeah. I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
People,
did you get to sit in on any of the test screenings, Dan? Because I feel like the thing you were kind of robbed of is a nice theatrical release for this movie, and we'll talk more about that. But did you get to at least sit with an audience with this?
Yeah, I didn't. We didn't do any test screenings. We didn't do any recruited test screenings. We just did friends and family screenings, and we did it. We do them all the time. I did one before I finished the director. I did one way too early. It was like way early to do it, and I regret. You know, some people, because the movie has changed so much and has become so much better. And I'm sort of like, oh God, they saw me, you know, too soon. But I absolutely, been in those experiences, and they're, you know, to feel this movie more than just having great sound, great picture and great sound, which is essential. And you're missing half the work of the people have done on the movie when you don't have those things. When you're watching it, but really it's such a fun crowd movie because, you know, cheers, not just for awesome predator kills, but like the beat that Amber sucks that tomahawk back into her hand after she takes down those guys.
So good.
Having an applause break, which was, I did, not to sound like I'm an asshole, but I remembered, this is a weird reference, but I brought this up way too much to everyone. So I've just, you guys will, I think, be the few that would appreciate. But I remembered watching the Wachowski Jupiter Ascending.
Mm-hmm.
There's one sequence with Channing and her, the action sequence where they're descending outside in jump boots the whole time. And then they land. Jeff, did I see this movie with you?
We reviewed it on TRS.
We did? Okay, yeah. Then I did. Then
I think you
land.
Mentioned this.
Oh
in
my
your
God,
review.
Jeff, so you're a part, this is you. And then people cheer.
Yeah.
And it's mainly because it's the musicality of it. The music gets so loud and oh my God, it's intense, and then it stops.
Yeah.
And they've just now, they were in the sky. They went. And it makes it incites a cheer.
It gives you a beat to do that. It breathes for a second and it lets you do that. Yeah.
And so that moment was that. And of course, I'm never hearing cheers in the edit room, you know. And I'm like, and in pitching what we want the music to do, it was this music, it was that music. I was like, no, it's got to do this thing, you know. And no one's like, you know, like, you know, like, okay, but shouldn't it, you know, it's like, no, it's going to, you know.
Awesome.
And then when we screen it, it like has that, and it's so good. It's so fun. It's not just like cheering when the crazy gore happens, but like cheering her on is just so cool. To feel that from people. So
that's so good,
yeah.
I saw a question on Twitter today that never occurred to me that I want to ask your opinion on. This comes from Ali Balam, who said. I was surprised not to hear mention of my favorite subverted expectation in the movie when post quicksand, Amber Mid Thunder is covered in mud only to go wash it off in the very next scene. Was that was intentional of like, oh,
big time.
Yeah. I didn't even catch that when I have seen the movie multiple times.
So let's explain kind of the subverted expectation or what the expectation would have been, right?
Because in the original Predator, Arnold learns to cover himself with, in when he's covered up with mud that the predator doesn't see him because the predator has heat vision and you know.
Yeah.
So we knew we wanted to do the same structure of she needs to learn that she can outwit the heat vision, but I really felt like it would be a chore for the audience to be like, oh, when's she gonna get in the mud? Oh, she's in the mud. Now you're like, you feel like we know, we get it. So the exciting thing
to be fair, I don't think anyone would have actually, you know, maybe like people like on this podcast.
Really?
I don't
I feel like people would. But but what's great is that we were able to combine two ideas, which is one, having a quicksand moment in the movie, and then B, doing this thing where she's covered in mud and she gets out and she's in the mud, and the hope is that people are like, Well, now she's invisible to Predator. Now I see how she wins. Oh, that's how she wins. She just because she fell in the mud, but that's how she wins. And then the next scene is clearing off the mud, and people are going, oh, this movie. Then you feel like the movie could do it. It could go, oh, I don't know where this movie is going. I thought I knew the movie, and the movie is, you know, that was the intent. It's like a horror movie where, like, you kill the unexpected character, and then you go, oh, well, anyone can die in this movie, you know, like, sort of wanting to do that narratively.
Yeah. All right, folks, I think we should start wrapping up soon. So last call for questions from Devinder and Jeff. I have two more questions, but one is just about long continuous shot action scene, Dan Trachtenberg. You know, I'm a fan of a nice one-er. What was kind of the idea behind the long continuous action sequence? And you know, why did you want to do it this in the way that you did it?
I didn't want to do it.
That, it's hard. That, I hate the idea. You specifically were like, Dave Chen likes these, therefore please remove them from the film.
Well, not it wasn't Dave Chen likes these. Sorry, my thing is it's so trendy.
Mm.
The one-er, so trendy. And so I really was allergic to that. And there are lots of one-ers in this movie, but
You didn't want to be basic, you know? I love
a good Spielberg one-er, the one-er that no one knew until the video essay was made. Like, yep. All these, like, and they're not like, it's a 12-minute scene. It's a whole episode, though. I've seen a couple of those whole episodes that are, and they're great. So, I love all of them. I don't know, no slight. But I love, you know, this in Jaws has all these scenes that are like, that was 2 minutes, where there was all one take, because that was the best way to tell that moment. It wasn't like, look at what we did as a team. And but at the same time, I knew, I wrestled with this literally till the day we shot it, because I was tempted to be like, she's gonna take them down all in one breath, you know. I knew there would be something very winning about, like, oh my god. On the flip side, as you know, and we know what makes for a good action scene, and it's very clear, clean choreography and geography. And I know what I like, and I know how to cut. I'm a fan of those, you know, and I was very excited to shoot it in a way that we could see all of these awesome moves that I loved what she, and understanding that she's improvising as she's going, and she's, oh my God, this happened. So now I got to get that. I had it all covered. I had it all figured out to, like, showcase, but hopefully still in an invisible way, because I didn't want to be, you know, but like understand the reactionary nature of the sequence for her. But we were running out of time. We were late on a thing, and the studio was nervous. I still get texts about the scene from the head of the studio. When he sees compliments for this shot, because it was like we did not have it. We were running out of time.
Mm-hmm. And you're like, told ya.
And so I said, instead of spending 2 to 3 days covering
fewer setups,
the scene,
we need fewer setups. Trachtenberg,
it was like, I'll just take 1 day, and we'll spend all day to get this shot. Mm. But we'll then have it, and it will have only been a day, or maybe even if we're lucky, half a day or three quarters of a day, so we can then start whatever we had to do next. But luckily, I think we found a way in which it's cover. You see all of the. But you see all of the bits that you need to see. It feels like the cameraman is just capturing them. Like, it's like the combination of, it's not, the Bourne quick editing, or Michael Bay, you know, the thing that, where action scenes are very experiential, not very understood, but you feel them. And that was the first Bourne was like, oh, wow, you really felt the action in a way that you hadn't felt, which is different than the Jackie Chan and all those, where it's like, oh, I'm seeing, it's awesome the way it looks. Mm-hmm. And so my hope was that we could cover in a way that felt gritty, where the camera's just capturing it,
yes.
Yet you do see it. You do get to. You don't miss any of the cool. You know, you do see the moves, and the camera feels the way that she, like, it's suddenly ferocious and improvisational and quick on its feet and oh my god and all those things. So, anyway, it was trying to combine the two ideas of a clear understanding of the geography and choreography, but also needing to get it all done in a one-er, and a one-er that I know you guys appreciate, but I think I think most people aren't going to watch it going, wow, look at that filmmaking. Mm-hmm. It's like more of like, oh, I can breathe.
You feel it. You feel it.
At the end, they feel like they can take the breath again, you know?
Yeah.
A reluctant oneer. It was a reluctant one.
The reluctant one. The, reluctant, the story, the Dan Trachtenberg story. That's so funny.
Were there any kind of tough decisions you had to make when it came to, you're talking about like production schedule, but like, I know there's like a bunch of CG in the movie. And I guess I'm curious, like, I know you're someone that like, likes a classic film look, you know, that like wants everything to feel real and practical. And I guess I'm curious, like, how did you make some of those trade-offs between like stuff that you like really want to do practically, but you had to do it CG or vice versa?
They really didn't love my pitch for having a real bear chasing Amber.
Isn't there that one Hollywood bear though that everybody gets?
We inquired about that. There's also being a Disney film, it was very interesting that they have very strict rules for good about animals and using fur in movies and all those things. It's very strict and made this movie in particular quite challenging. But the animals, the CG. What's interesting is the Predator is I don't want to say contingent, but there's a feeling of, oh, the CG of the Predator. It's like, dude, it's one shot. You know, there's like one shot. I mean, there's several shots where we had enhancements on bits of the Predator that no one's criticizing those, you know. And there's one shot of its face where it's largely CG, not entirely CG, but largely CG. But yeah, I try to make it a combination as much as possible. It's very tricky with what's happening in the visual effects industry now. Is real rough. Some advice to fans of the show that want to become filmmakers, if you want a job in the film industry, get into visual effects because they need more. That there's a crazy shortage of artists. It really was enough time, enough man hours could be put into finishing all the visual effects the way that we wished we could have. But also some of the work is invisible and tremendous. Some of it's visible.
Is there something that you're like, that's invisible and you're really like proud of it in the movie that you're like?
I think there's a bit when he, in the Burnt Glade sequence where the Predator decloaks and then he's got ash on his hands and brings them up to his face to like sniff the ash, like whatever. His face is real. And that's practical. It's great. I think it's one of the best looks of that design of the build. His hands are completely CG in that shot, or they're mapped over in CG.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone knows that that's a CG element of that.
Huh. Yeah. That's awesome.
So I think that's tremendous. And then there's other times when you see an animal. Sometimes it's real. Sometimes it's, but always the idea behind the thing is. My last thought on that is like one of the guiding principles, because knowing that there was a chance we were biting off more than we could chew for this, was I remember watching the movie Snowpiercer, which we all loved that movie, and the CG is awful.
It's pretty rough, bad. Like of the outside of the train, look great.
Yeah,
doesn't look
good.
Great.
Give two shits. Could give to you because it doesn't if the idea you needed that seat, you needed to tell that story. So it wasn't like we hate bad CG when it's in a movie that's not great or what it's trying to articulate or express, didn't need to be done anyway.
Yeah.
So it feels gratuitous, whatever. But when the idea behind the thing is cool,
you'll
forgive it or it's narratively necessary. So that's what we try to do with all these moments is like, so even if we fall short, we know that it was a necessary beat, and I enjoyed the idea the concept behind that is so winning that I can forgive. I can forgive it for not being great. And some of the concepts behind it are the VFX artists. You know, it's the way that thing moves, even if it feels CG, even if the final render, whatever, couldn't be. You know, but the way that they decided, I think the bear mauling the Predator in the river, the way that it's going at it, the sound design in that moment, and that wasn't always that way. You know, the bear for the fight that came from a lot of iterating with that crew of how can the bear, when to really feel like the bear is being the most bear and the predator is being the most, really taking those action figures and clashing them together. And yeah, the way the bear handles that is an animator's idea. That is this VFX, that's a whole department, a character animator. And it's like, how do we make that thing feel that way? And even if you feel like that's a CG bear, but what it's doing is so cool that you can kind of forgive it a little bit, I think, you know?
Yeah,
so,
yeah, totally, yeah. Totally.
Great point.
All right, I have one last question. That's a lot of conversation has sprung up around other permutations of the Predator. The Predator with samurai, the Predator with pirates, the Predator with gangsters from the 1900s. You know, like, people have really been kind of getting out there with their ideas about the Predator. And I guess I'm curious, of these or of any ideas that have come up, like, are there any that really resonate with you without giving away potential future entries?
I knew you were going to say that. I can't, yeah, because there's no way. I know. I used to do this podcasting. You know, anything I say is like, oh, that's the headline. Dan thinks samurais would be cool. So that clearly the next thing is.
How dare you assume
what do you
that
think?
I would do it that way?
What do you?
How dare you take our perfectly good headlines from us, Dan?
What do you
live
you
on
guys?
Headlines?
Yeah.
By the way, my. I can't really say. I think there's other things. Obviously, Predator multiple time periods is super awesome. I also think there's other things that the Predator franchise hasn't done yet.
That's exciting.
Romantic comedy, potentially.
Yes.
That would be awesome.
Heist movie, you know, a Predator heist
Predator
movie.
Versus aliens. No, Predator loves aliens.
But what time period do you guys, what would you want to see?
Well, I think that what's so great about Prey is that it opens up your imagination to, like, yeah, wow. Right. Like I had, honestly, Dan, when I first heard the idea, I was like, this doesn't make any sense. I mean, the Predator, like, people in modern day technology could barely withstand this guy.
Wait, this was your opinion that we were talking about? This revealed the end of the episode.
I'm using sock puppet accounts. Like 99% of the negative sentiment is from me, FYI.
Right.
But no, I'm being exaggerative and being facetious, you know, because I think, like, oh, the idea of, like, a predator going back in time, it's like, wow, how could they ever stand a chance? What this movie illustrates is there is a way. There is a way to have a predator go back in time and face off, yeah?
It's now a Disney franchise, so you can do Predators of the Caribbean.
I think, not for nothing, but that is the actual, in the comics, that is the comic book canon of the Andolini.
Yeah.
Rafael Andolini pistol, but...
Is it going to be movie canon then, Trachtenberg? No.
The thing that I hope people don't miss, and certainly if I were to be involved with other time periods or whatever, it isn't really the reason why this, I think. There have been other 1700s, 1800s movies with aliens in them. Yeah. And that felt like peanut butter and mayonnaise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Certain whereas, cowboys in aliens.
Seriously, anyway. Whereas,
yes. Whereas this feels like peanut butter and chocolate, you know, or jelly, whatever. Depending on what country you hail from. Is because it's not just like, oh, isn't it cool to see Predator in a different time period? And oh, there's warriors in all time periods, whatever. Is that this, there's a narrative, there's a thematic reason the movie is saying something. And not just culturally, I know you guys are speaking to that a lot in your review, but emotionally, the things that we all wrestle with. Am I good enough? Can I handle, I worry about I doubting my own abilities. Am I capable of doing something? If the Predator brings out that theme, looking for the alpha, looking for the strong, looking for the most capable, you know, so that's what any other Predator movie, any other time period, whatever, it's like, it needs to be like, oh, it's a better movie for that. It's got a thematic weight to it. It's not just look at the fun Predator in this time period.
I get choked up. I've seen the movie multiple times. And I get choked up every time she says, I'm the dangerous one," or whatever that line is. You know, the emotion is there, and I think it's a good point.
Yeah,
I do have a last question, Dave. If I may, it has nothing to do with Prey.
It's when are we going to?
When are we going on vacation? No. My question, Daniel, is you mentioned in passing there, and just in the last response, that you used to do a podcast. On said podcast that you used to do, there was a year, who can say when it was, but when that podcast named one movie in particular the movie of the year, it was the consensus amongst all of its hosts that it was the movie of the year. That movie, James Cameron's Avatar. And there are other hosts on this podcast that don't really give that movie its due. And I wondered if you had any words that you wanted to share about your feelings about the cultural relevance of James Cameron's Avatar.
Really calling in the ringer here, Jeff. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to take my shots while I can get them. How many times is Dan going to be here for me to be able to do this?
I loved Avatar.
Yeah, that's right.
Jake Sully, Nate Thierry, I can name them.
You're just going down your trivia list that you remembered once these articles started coming out.
What Dave says is, can you even name the main character?
Incredible movie. Incredible movie. Are you excited for the sequels, Dan?
I'm so excited. You know, the trailer for the new one.
What's the name of the new one, Dan? So excited, buddy!
Way of the Water?
Yes!
Yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah. It's the way of water. The Way of Water.
Way of Water.
I don't think it's a the. Yeah. I don't think there's a the, Dave. Yeah. You're a stickler about no
the. I
did
hear James Cameron may have dug.
Okay, Jeff, you fucking said on the podcast there's no the. There is a the. And I corrected you on the podcast too.
There is a
the. I remembered you correcting me, but I thought it was the other way around.
No, you said there's no the, Dave. I'm like, there's a the. And then you were like, okay, anyway.
Okay,
sorry,
the
Dave.
Avatar Way of Water.
I don't like it when our disagreements spill out into the open.
Dan's trying to tell us what James Cameron is doing. Yeah, I want to hear this.
Sorry. But Dave! No, I'm sorry.
I used to host a podcast with Jeff.
I know. We know.
What?
I know.
How dare you?
Yeah.
You were supposed to be in my corner on this one.
No, I was just saying I think he dug Prey. But
lovely.
Awesome.
So I'm going to choose my words carefully cuz I hated Avatar. No, I'm just kidding. I love it. I'll tell you that, you know, the trailer is not the greatest trailer.
Not a good trailer.
That trailer.
Yeah.
But the music in it is very Enya/Echo the Dolphin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which I love the piano version of the Avatar score is very beautiful.
It's that kind of music. It's very nostalgic for me and very 90s and not what you expect to hear these days in an action movie or blah, you know, whatever. Like I really I loved that vibe. And I liked My Family is a Fortress. Our families, like and focusing on that, you know, and the thing of like, the ambition of that is probably quite large in terms of.
It's been 2 decades since we've had Enya in an action movie. She's Lord of the Rings. She did.
I don't know that it is Enya.
Just something like that. To be clear, just want to make it all absolutely clear here. Nobody here hates Avatar. What we are talking about is the cultural vacuum that has formed around it. How the most successful movie ever made could, you know, almost a decade later, be something where nobody was really talking about
on this podcast.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, you know, this has been a wonderful conversation with a talented filmmaker.
Yeah.
And I can't
wait to ruin it.
I can't believe you ended it this way, but
yeah,
I think, you know, that's going to be, sorry, Dan, do you have anything else to say?
Dave, what did you think of the score?
Of Prey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Yeah.
And Dave awesome. Chen, I don't know if everyone yeah. knows how much Dave Chen loves cellos. There's so much cello in this score. Cello.
Yes. It's amazing.
Threatening cello is a good vibe.
All the cellos. Sarah plays all the cellos herself. There's
incredible.
There's bits that sound like electric guitar, like anything, and it's just freaking gnarly cellos, you know?
Yes. Love it. Cello's an incredible instrument.
Really creative score. Yeah.
I think you just titled your next album, Dave, Gnarly Cellos. That's good. Yes. That's really good.
Yes, indeed. I think, you know, I don't know why my mom chose cello as the instrument I was going to play when I was a kid, but I think part of it had to do with the fact that not very many people like to play cellos because it's a large, inconvenient instrument to take around with you.
Everybody. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, and as a result, I'm really into cellos now. And and the Prey score had a lot of amazing cellos and a lot of it's a great score and very different than you know, the score for say the Predator, you know, like. It kind of forges new territory with the style and instrumentation. So
it sounds unlike anything out right now, to be honest. Like, I feel like a lot of, especially action movie scores, have kind of like fallen into very familiar themes and sounds. So this felt very unique. Yeah,
yeah.
The interesting thing is that it started out. I mean, I the whole time we wanted it to not to feel like music that you don't normally hear in a movie set in the 1700s. And we tempt with a lot of Sicario, and droney ambient, whatever. And there's still a little bit of that in the movie, and certainly score that you don't instrumentation that you don't really hear, whatever. But then there's also this aspect to it that is high adventure, sweeping, fantasy. You know, that I did not think was going to be in the movie that I desperately want. I mean, I dreamed of having a movie
we'll
one day
that.
Have score like that, and that does feel. It just I love that it can have both, and that Sarah, you know, just wrote beautiful music that I would listen to while forgetting. It's not just doing the job that it needs to do in a movie.
Yeah,
it's also
it stands
beautiful
on its own
music.
Exactly.
You know, I just think it's so great.
You should have gone hardcore though, Dan. You should have only done the score using instruments available at the time. I think that was my biggest disappointment. You know,
there's a lot of those too. There's a number of those.
Yeah. But anyway,
I was fortunate enough to be able to see it, you know, with temp score and then see it again with the final score. And it's huge. I mean, incredible. She did an amazing job. Yeah,
I agree. Yeah.
Well, Dan, this has been an absolute pleasure. Everyone here on this podcast is rooting for you and your success in the future. We can't wait to see what you do next. And we're really grateful that you've taken the time to chat with us about the movie. And
the length of the movie, pretty much, it looks like.
Yes, for the length of the movie. Really appreciate it. But yes, I'm speaking with Jeff Cannata, Devinder Hardwar, and of course, the director of films such as 10 Cloverfield Lane and Prey, currently streaming on Hulu right now. Dan Trachtenberg, man, thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I look forward to your next review. I feel it coming. Will not have bias. I think you guys have spent all of your bias on this one.
All the bias on this movie.
Permission to speak freely. I really didn't love this, but I'm really, you know, like, I think that's coming the next time. And I welcome it, Dave.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, I am David Chen. You've been listening to the Filmcast After Dark. Find us at thefilmcast.com and also at youtube.com/filmcast. Support the podcast at patreon.com/filmpodcast. We'll see you later.